to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This story is titled A Night in Elf Hill. Written by Norman Spinrad, it comes from the book The Farthest Reaches, edited by Joseph Elder. Dear Fred, yeah, it's your brother Spence after all these years, and of course I'm yelling for help. Spare me the I told you so's and the psychiatrist's pounce. So I'm a black sheep and a miscreant and a neurotic personality. We never could quite stand each other, even when we were kids. And when you became a shrink and I shipped out, well, that really tore it. The reality of inner space versus the escapism of outer space. Maturity versus perpetual adolescence. Isn't that what you said? Sometimes I think you were born speaking that jargon. And if you'll pardon my saying so, I still think it's horse hockey. But the bitch is that now I find myself urgently in need of your brand of horse hockey. See, I've got something I've got to tell to somebody. Something that's been eating me up for a year. Something way over my head. Something you only tell a brother or a shrink. And for all your squareness, Fred, at least you're both. I suppose I've got you good and confused by now, just like in the bad old days, but I hope I've got you as intrigued as Bug. Now, don't go putting things in my mouth, though. I've got no regrets. 17 years in space, and I don't regret a minute of it. But you never could understand that. Remember? I tell you about the kick of 10 new planets every year, of a new woman on every one of them, of the greener grass just beyond the planet, beyond the next one. And what I'd get from you is long lectures on flight from reality and compulsive satirism. The only reason I'm raking up these tired old coals, Herr Doctor, is that it all bears on the problem that I'm going to do my damnedest to try and dump in your lap. You know how the time limit on merchant service papers works. Or at least you should know, since shrinks like you stuck us with this system. When you apply for papers, they give you a solid week of physical and mental examinations, everything, and the book, and some things that aren't. And they tell you just how long they figure you can stand the jumping in and out of subspace, the accelerations, the pressures, the tensions. They tell you how long. They put it down on your papers. This man's certified for 18 years in space and not a millisecond longer. The moving finger writes and all that. Actually, I've got no fair reason to complain. 18 years is a good time. The average is closer to 15. Yeah, a good, safe, secure system, Fred. The only thing wrong with it is that you know you have that date hanging over your head. And you know that under the rules, the day will come when you start collecting that mustering out pension. A nice piece of change every year as long as you live, even to a high-priced shrink like you, Fred. And you get that last free ride to the planet of your choice. Sure, you think it's a sweet setup. You would. 18 years of your life in return for financial security in perpetuity. Why don't you go to Port Kennedy and take a good hard look at all those old men sitting in the sun? Those guys living off their nice fat pensions and watching the ships taking off for the stars like one-eyed cats peeping in a seafood store. Old men of 35 or 40. Ask them if it's such a sweet setup. Man, I'm sure glad this is a letter, because I can all but hear you bellowing something like, I told you so. What was it you used to call shipping out? A night in Elf Hill. Yeah, where a man goes into the Hall of the Elves for one night of partying, and the next day when he comes out 100 years have passed. He's an old man, an old, old man, and his life's over. I can hear you telling me that I can't find myself by searching the galaxy, that I've got to look within. Now, look at you, Spence. You're a hollow shell, a 38-year-old adolescent. Yeah, I can see you shaking your head with infinite sadness and infinite wisdom. And you should be glad this isn't face-to-face, too, Fred, because I'd kick your sanctimonious teeth right down your throat. And you know I always could lick you. Suffice it to say that unless you can come up with some pearl of wisdom from out of your bottomless pit of middle-aged maturity, and don't get me wrong, Fred, I hope to God you can, when I'm mustered out next year, that last trip won't be back to Earth. It'll be to Mandala. I know, you've never heard of Mandala. Who has? It's a nothing little planet orbiting a G4 sun. Colonized about a century ago, maybe 15 million yokums living off a piddling mining industry on one continent. That's Mandala. 10,000 mud balls just like it is scattered all over the galaxy. But I'm afraid, I'm really afraid that unless you can stop me, Fred, I'm going back. Going back to stay. I made my first planet fall in Mandala a little over a year ago on a freighter from Sidewinder carrying the kind of cargo we just don't talk about. The population's small. There's only one town with nearly enough people to call itself a city. The outback has been pretty thoroughly explored by air. No interesting local beasties or natives. The colony's just not old enough to have really marinated, if you dig, become decadent enough to appeal to my peculiar taste. But, now let's not go into that. Still, like it or not, I had 3 days on this mud ball. I knew from long experience that a planet's just too big a place to be a total nonentity. That's why I went into space in the first place. That's where it's really at. Not all that crap about the vast spaces between the stars. Nah, space itself is creation's most total bore. What makes a guy ship out is just being a kid on Earth and looking up at all those stars and knowing that they all own whole worlds and that each of them is a world as full of surprises as Earth was when Adam and his chick got themselves booted out of Eden. I guess that's it. You've got to dig surprises. A man like me hates security as much as you love it. So, Fred, I knew there had to be something for me on Mandala. A new taste, a new sound, a new woman, a nice surprise. Well, I wandered from bar to bar, my usual SOP, and to make a long, tedious story short, I came up with only two little goodies, and one of them seemed to be just a fairy story at first. But the second concerned the race with no name. The race had left one of its weird ruins on Mandala. Even you must know about the race with no name. Billions of years ago, before man was even a far distant gleam in some dinosaur's eye, before the Botas or the Dreers or any of the other races that are around today ever existed, the race with no name owned this galaxy from the center clear to the Magellanic Clouds. A billion years ago, they disappeared, died out, or migrated elsewhere, God knows what, leaving nothing but ruins on thousands of planets. But you know that. What you don't know, Fred, is what the race means to spacers. See, it's our own private little nightmare that somewhere, somehow, some of them are still around, and that one day we're going to run into them in subspace or on some forgotten planet on the rim. A race a billion years gone. A race that was young when the galaxy was coalescing. A race that had as much in common with us as we do with worms. A race that we can't be sure doesn't still exist somewhere. But then there was that local fairy story. It seems that a few decades ago, a Mandalan who had been a spacer settled down on his pension near something called the Great Swamp. Apparently, he wigged out, was known to rave about someplace in the swamp that was the most beautiful city in the galaxy. Of course, there was no such thing in the swamp. And one day, he just sort of disappeared and never found his body. The locals claimed that other men had disappeared into the Great Swamp, but nobody I talked to could name names. Just the usual crock, you're thinking, huh? But the race with no name had left a ruin on Mandala. And when you added that to the fairy story, you ended up with something that smelled of artifact. I guess they've found maybe 24 intact artifacts of the race with no name. I lose count. There's the solid hole on Beauchamp, the time trap on Flor del Cielo, and the subspace block on Misty. That horrible thing they haven't even named on Chani, the thing that turns living creatures inside out. No one knows what any of the damn things really are, and I suppose we never will. Maybe I hope we never will. But I got the smell of artifact on Mandala. Somewhere in that swamp was something. No matter how many men have died or worse because of them, I still never heard of a spacer who could resist the lure of discovering an artifact. Don't ask me why. Why do people pick at scabs there, doctor? So anyway, I went to the flitter, bought some tinned food, leased an energy rifle, which everyone assured me was about as necessary as a conversion bomb, and set out for the Great Swamp. The swamp was where it was supposed to be, about 400 miles east of the city. Great Swamp turned out to be local hyperbole, of course. You could lose it in the Everglades. I set the flitter down in a clearing near the center of the swamp. One weird thing, the trees were lousy with a kind of feathery stuff like Spanish moss, long globs of it hanging everywhere. It was a deep, deep red. It gave you the feeling that you were walking through perpetual sunset. Kind of eerie, maybe, but also kind of soothing. Quite a few critters around, ugly, little, lumpy fish like mud puppies in the stream, small, six-legged blue lizards all over the place, octopoid things swinging in the trees by their tentacles like monkeys, but nothing big enough to worry about, even without the rifle. But I must admit that I sort of dug the place. It put me at ease. Even smelled kind of sweet and musky as I went deeper into it. And of course, that's when I should have started to sweat. I don't care how tame a planet is, it just shouldn't seem harmless if it isn't Earth. Every planet's different from every other in thousands of ways, and at least one of those differences should be the kind that makes a man look behind him. Besides, every other extraterrestrial swamp I've ever seen stank like an open cesspool. Well, I must have just wandered around for hours before I felt, how do I describe it, a kind of scratchy shiver in my head, like running a broken fingernail down a piece of slate. An awful feeling, but it just came and went in a moment. All of a sudden, things got kind of dreamy-like. I went on in kind of a daze, and that scratchy feeling came and went again. And a very funny thing happened. I found myself remembering all kinds of things. Women I had known, the taste of blondie wine and fried prawns, the smell of Chandor Afrofume, the sun flashing on the ruby beach, the carnival feel of Briala. Good things. A whole life full of good things, all whipping through my mind like someone had recorded the best moments of my life on tape and was playing the whole damn thing back 100 times normal speed. It was like being high on mescal and bang and dubrish and all at once. I got flashes of that, too. I mean, Fred, memories of what being high was really like, mixed in with the rest of it. I forgot everything. The reason I was in the swamp. The fact that I had to be back on the ship in 2 days. Forgot even my depression at the impending mustering out. And I just wandered around, reliving the best moments of my life at breakneck speed. And then I felt that awful nerve-tingling feeling again, stronger this time. It seemed to last for hours. Then it was gone again, and I was standing on top of a little hill. And there below me, where it just couldn't possibly be, was a city. The city. The city that Mandalan Spacer had raved about. And he had been dead right. It was the most beautiful place in the galaxy. Translucent towers of emerald a mile high, piercing the clouds like artificial mountains, hundreds of them. And the streets of the city wound around their feet, streets jammed with buildings from 100 planets and cultures. Argolian force pavilions, mosques, Boharan, flowers, skyscrapers, stadia, all shimmering and flickering in the ever-changing light that seemed to come from the towers that made the sky above the city a great rainbow aurora. A river separated the foot of my hill from the city. A bridge crossed the river and a road crossed the bridge. The road was a ribbon of burnished silver. The bridge was a single, arching, dazzling, living crystal that might have been diamond. The river was a flow of liquid gold. The capital city of the universe. Utterly stupefying, utterly impossible, and yet I had that, deja vu feeling that I had somehow seen it before. What can I say, Fred? I must have been out of my head. It couldn't be there, but it was. And I couldn't even think of all the impossibilities of the situation, the sheer insanity of it all. I ran down that hill like a sex-starved hermit toward a Mexican border town, down the silver road, across the diamond bridge. And I was there, totally there. Ever been in Rio at the height of the carnival? Ever spent Mardi Gras in old New Orleans? You ever heard of how Rialo becomes one great citywide party on settling day eve? Well, triple that, Fred. Raise it to its own power. Take a big drag of opium, and man, you won't even come close. It just sucked me in, whoosh. The streets were simply boiling with people and beings. Golden women from Topaz, tall green jungle masters from Azan, Sevenfolka from Siegfried, dressed in clinging mirror suits, gleamer-faced chirubotas, women with hair piled into nests for shimmering ghrelin glass butterflies, beings from 1,000 planets all babbling and laughing. Carnival sounds, Fred, laughter, singing, music. Carnival smells, perfume, frying food, hashish smoke, wine, women. I felt as if I'd stepped into the Arabian Nights. Any minute a fine carpet might float by. I felt as if I had been searching for this place, this huge carnival, this moment in time all my life. I wanted to laugh and scream and cry. And then I felt that itching in my mind again, and I saw her coming toward me, straight toward me through that packed throng which seemed to drift away before like fog melting away in the sun. She was wearing those now opaque, now transparent golden robes from topaz. She was almost my height, had exotic oriental features, but bone-white skin. Luminous emerald hair cascaded onto her shoulders. She had a slim but full body, and through a momentary transparency in her robes, I saw that her nipples were an impossible blood red, matching the color of her small, full lips. She was like no woman anyone had ever seen. And yet as she stood before me, I had that uncanny deja vu feeling again. I knew her, but from where? Ridiculous. How could any man forget a woman like this? She touched my hand, and the thrill went through me like a jolt from a pleasure box.
Hello. I've been waiting for you. We've all been waiting a long, long time. Just for you. Come. Come join the carnival.
She laughed, reached up, curled her hands around my neck, and kissed me. Her mouth was warm and open, and the taste of her breath made me forget everything. I moved my body against her, asking the question, and she answered me with a counter-pressure that was more than a compliance, more certain than an open invitation. She snaked her hands down my neck, over my shoulders, across my chest, and took both my hands in hers. She nodded toward the choked, swirling streets.
Come on. The best night of your life is waiting for you, and the darkness is just beginning.
How long does all this go on?
Forever. For you, this can be the night that lasts forever.
And before I could say a word, before I could tell whether I was eager or afraid, she tugged at my hands and we were off into the carnivaling city together. She led me through the streets, through the laughing packed streets, past knots of humans and bodas and dreers, open stands offering food and wine and drugs from all over the galaxy. And then finally into, I don't know, a house, a room, a place, a great round hall. The walls, a circle of marble columns past which I caught glimpses of other halls and rooms and passageways beyond. They seemed to go on and on and on. A labyrinth of rooms and hallways packed with people and beings and tables bearing food and drink. An endless, continuous party that wound through the hall and the rooms beyond and perhaps the entire city without limits, without end. We drifted from crowded room to packed courtyard. A dark chamber where naked women danced to the pounding beat of African drums. An open court by the Golden River where we sat on white sands, inhaling mutar from topaz, and watched the Golden Ones do their insidious water dance. A neon-lit room where weirdly dressed kids danced to the music of an ancient Terran rock band. The amorphous building seemed to be the city itself, and the city was one wild carnival of food and music and dancing, swirling, laughing, and completely carrying me away. It seemed that I had but to think of something, a certain food, a wine I remembered, a music I'd heard, and it was there, anything I ever wanted, ever could want. And when the time came when there was only one more thing I wanted, we turned a corner, stepped through a doorway, and we were suddenly alone. We were floating in a dark chamber, floating in nothing at all. A velvet, buoying nothing, softer somehow than freefall itself. She threw aside her robes, and all at once her body seemed to glow with a warm, golden light. She plucked at my clothes, and then I was naked too, and my body was glowing from within like hers. When we made love, it seemed as if we were alone in the whole universe. The light of our bodies, the only light there was. She was perfect, and I was better. You know me, Fred, so you know what I mean when I say it was the best I had ever had and the best I'd ever been. It made me forget every woman I'd ever known. And afterward, I wasn't tired at all. I was full of vitamins and ready for another night of partying. So we laughed and kissed and was back to that endless, fantastic party. We swam nude in a pool of gold and water heated to blood heat under a huge silver moon on moonless Mandala. And then... and we stretched out on a lawn of bright green grass while a warm, perfumed breeze swiftly dried our bodies. I reached out and touched one perfect breast.
Ken.
It brought me up short. I suddenly went cold. I never told her my name. That one impossibility somehow reminded me that I was here in the middle of a swamp where there was no city, where I was afraid, furious and afraid. I pulled my hand away and asked, "Who are you? What is..." She leaned toward me, kissed me, and the question seemed stupid, trivial. But something in me was still fighting it. I shoved her away and asked, "What the hell is all this? What's going on here?"
"Do you really have to know?"
But I wasn't buying. Something was being done to me, and I had to know what. Tell me, or...
"If you insist, I've got to tell you. But don't insist. Take my word for it, Spence. You won't like what you hear. What do you care what we are, where you are? Look around you. Smell the air. Hear the music. Touch my body. Do you want to lose all this? Can any place be like this for you again? Will you ever have another night like this? Ever?"
I felt a terrible aching sadness. I knew she was right, knew that this moment right now, this night and no other, past or future, was the best I could ever know. I was a spacer with less than 2 years left on my papers, and suddenly I felt like an old, old man. From this moment, the rest of my life could only be a long, gray, downhill slide to nothingness.
"It doesn't have to be. This moment, this night, this place, this carnival never has to end. Not for you. Forever, Spence. It can last forever. And forever is a long, long time."
"Tell me!" I screamed at her, shaking her shoulders, driven by some savage compulsion, perhaps the knowledge that I was being offered something that in another moment I would be powerless to resist. Suddenly, a terrible pain sheared through my head, and the city, the pool, her, flickered for a moment and were gone. I was lying on the moist, black swamp earth. I was dressed, my clothes were clammy, my stomach ached with hunger. It was night. And I was alone and heard a voice in my mind saying,
"A billion years. A billion years is a long time to be alone, unused, discarded like a broken toy."
"Who? What? What are you? Her? The city?"
"You. Mostly you. And a little of me. I looked into your mind, read your memories, your desires, things you didn't even know yourself. And I gave it to you. What you wanted. What you really wanted. It was easy. That's what I was. Made for doing. A billion years ago."
"All an illusion? Just a reflection of my dreams?"
"You underestimate the subtlety of the mastery. Those you call the race with no name. No mere wish fulfillment for them. Every world in this galaxy was theirs. But it was not enough for them. They craved new worlds. Subjective worlds, worlds that lived and breathed and reflected their private whims, but worlds that were still apart from their minds, worlds that held surprises for their dirty, jaded minds. None of them mere dreams, but none of them real."
"But you're real. You're talking to me now."
"I'm real. You would call me an artifact. They created me out of metal and force. And things you could never understand. They gave me the power to read the innermost thoughts and desires of all sentient beings. The power to spin dreams, beautiful dreams without end. A toy. Just a toy. But they wanted more. They wanted passion. So they made me sentient. A living, caring thing. A thing with a will and only one motivation. The passion to please a sentient being. Any sentient being. And then, a billion years ago, they left for I know not where. And they left me here to rot, flung aside when they no longer were amused by their toy. They left me here to rot and suffer and yearn to please a sentient being. For a billion years, a billion empty years, till humans came to this planet."
I shivered in the warm night, felt monstrous things staring at me from out of the black, black night. From out of the unthinkable, distant past. But you're not a woman?
"I can give you every woman you could ever learn to want."
I want to see you."
"I cannot disobey the order of a sentient being, no matter how much I want to.
There was a movement in the trees, and I saw a dark shape, a slithering metallic thing, a lump of darkness blacker than the night. A wet sound, a cold, cold wind across my face, a vortex of something my eyes could not focus on. I felt myself falling into a black, black pool eaten alive by green, squamous things. I screamed and screamed and screamed. And all at once, I was standing in the middle of the diamond bridge, and she was standing before me.
I can't keep you from going.
She kissed me and gestured toward the great emerald spires, the carnival that went on and on and on.
All yours, Ben. Your own private heaven. A universe all for you. A universe that was made for you. Think of it. Being made love to by a whole universe. A night of pleasure that never ends. Forever, Spence. A special kind of forever.
What kind of forever?
What does it matter? A second, an hour, a day, a year, a billion years. If it seems like forever, it is forever, isn't it, Spence? And I can make it seem like forever. You know I can. I can't keep you from going, but can you keep from coming back?
Then she was gone, and the city was gone, and I was alone in the silence of the swamp. I stumbled forward a few steps, and my feet clattered against something in the dark, something hard and round. I reached down, touched it, and pulled my hand back. It was a skull, a human skull. I remembered the Mandalian spacer, and I felt the gnawing hunger in my guts, and I remembered that in the city I had eaten and eaten and eaten. What kind of forever? Well, now you know why I'm writing to you, Fred. Soon my papers will expire, and I'll have to pick one lousy planet out of a whole galaxy in which to spend the rest of my life. Please, Fred, look, talk me out of it. Say something, anything that will make it seem wrong. But make it good, brother mine, make it good, will you? Say something, anything, that'll keep me from going back to Mandala. Spence. You've heard a story by Norman Spinrad titled A Night in Elf Hill. It appears in the book The Farthest Reaches, edited by Joseph Elder. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Reading with me this time was Mindy Ratner. Technical production for Mind Webs by Leslie Hilsenhoff. Thank you.